So welcome, everyone. This is actually the last class of the Distorting Mind series. You don't have to be concerned. There are more distortions out there that we didn't cover. But we won't have a discussion next week because I'm off to IMS, and Heather Martin will be coming, so please come and listen to her talk. So tonight, I cap it all off with the arrogant mind. I sort of pick these themes. I don't know how I decide. I just think this would make a good talk. But then when you have to go into it and look at it, this was by far the hardest talk for me to consolidate into a theme, and because it's extraordinarily subtle how we do this. It's very interesting, because you can't say necessarily that if a person in a certain position is necessarily going to be arrogant. They may or may not be arrogant, and we know people in the same position who are arrogant and others who are not. Neither can we say necessarily that someone who is opinionated is, in fact, arrogant. Because there are lots of us who are opinionated but not arrogant. But we can say that if you are arrogant, you have opinions. And so it's a hard mental state to sort of get our hands around. The one thing that I can say about it is that it's almost a view of judgment, kind of a contemptuous judgment, where for such a long period of time, we have evaluated ourselves in a particular trait or characteristic, and it can be a skill or a quality of character, or it can be anything. Knowledge, placement, anything. As we abide within that skill, or in that quality, or in that characteristic, how we look out from that skill is often with contempt for those who are less skilled, less knowledgeable. And over time, the view of that judgment that is almost continuous, forms itself into a kind of view of life, which is what I would call the arrogant mind. Now, none of us that I know of in this room are free of it. It entraps us again and again, often from a particular vantage point of a skill or a knowledge or of a, you know, I'm a good cook, whatever we've kind of wrapped ourselves around as sort of a central theme in life for our identification. And we can get a sense of it just in the way we hold ourselves in relationship to other people who are attempting that skill or have similar knowledge. Just, you can get a feeling for it. As a culture, I think we're an arrogant culture. I would characterize one of the qualities of our culture is arrogance. You know, I went to the photographic display over at the Space Needle, the Seattle Center. It was called MILK Photograph, Moments, Intimacy, Laughter, Kinship Exhibition. And Ellen and I walked over, and it was outdoors, large photographs reminded me of the old album of the photographs of the Family of Man back in about the 1950s, I think it came out. Best photographers in the world compiled the photographs. And in this same photographic exhibition, the best photographers in the world internationally, along the themes of intimacy, laughter, and kinship, compiled their photographs, selections. And I was hard to look. You could go to any of those photographs. They were so endearing and be affected by any one of them. See the humanity that's present in the different displays and textures of skin color and cultural orientation and sophistication and age. Virtually every way that we judge or compare our culture, you could see the other culture's expression of humanity. And it's, I just would love to take our leadership through that display of photography and ask if it doesn't move their hearts so that they can't see other countries and other systems as them, because it was very much an us-based exhibition. And the other thing I did there, and I like to do from time to time, is watch the people who are seeing the photographs and see what we bring to our observation. And sometimes there was speed where people were just kind of racing through for whatever reason they had to move on. Other times they were so busy with multiple children that they really couldn't pay attention. But also there were ways that people were very affected by it, and I saw that. You could see it on their face or how they looked at the photograph. Or whether they were photographers themselves and whether they were looking technically at the sophistication of the photograph. And you could see that. Or you could see a kind of dismissiveness of the heart effect itself, that they were not going to get drawn in to the photographs in the way that the photographs necessitated it, and held a kind of reserve posture to the humanity that was displayed in front of them. So there are all of the whole range of that out there. But I think immediately what came to my mind was that the antidote to arrogance is seeing the common ground on which we all walk. It cuts the judgment right out from underfoot. And all of the ways that we generalize about people of other cultures, it just pulls right out. That every human being, every expression of humanity has the ability to laugh, to share intimacy, to love, and to appreciate friends and family. And so, arrogance is really at the heart of disconnection. In fact, I was giving a talk last night at the beginning series, and I mentioned the first precept, the precept to refrain from killing other living beings. And I thought about how that posture of swatting the fly or mashing the mosquito or shooting the deer is an extreme act of arrogance towards other life. That's in effect saying that other life is here to serve me. And if they don't do so, then they are to be exterminated. What good is the mosquito? There was a New York cartoon several years ago where it had a couple of deer resting on a hill looking down a slope, where two hunters with their rifles were walking up towards them. And one deer said to the other deer, "Why don't they thin their own goddamn herds?" From the perspective of life, what is the meaning of the human being? It certainly hasn't been an endearing species to most of the other species. But we hold enormous arrogance in relationship to our own sense of self-worth, don't we? So this mind state of arrogance is an important one to get a feeling for. It's an important one to become aware of, to begin to notice in ourselves. This posturing, this display, this pomp and ceremony. If we look at the pain that drives the arrogance, we must first look at the pleasure that we get from the arrogance. And certainly the reward is that sense of being special, of being unique. It's to rise up above the ordinary. It's the sense that there is something more prominent and noteworthy about oneself than about others of similar kind. And so it's really a screaming to be seen, to be acknowledged. Look at me. Hear me. Although the pain has long since been so subverted and resisted that the sense of arrogance often is disconnected from that pain in the posture of the way it holds the world, or seemingly a disconnect. It's become an assumption that I am better than. The hallmark of an arrogant mind is the resistance to listening, isn't it? So I found a Hafiz, who's a 12th century Sufi poet, about listening. How do I listen to others? As if everyone were my master speaking to me his cherished last words. How do I listen to others? As if everyone were my master speaking to me his cherished last words. That brings me right back into the photo exhibition again, where the availability to feel the humanity, to feel the connection, is once more on display in our own hearts. For if we're engaged through our hearts, then we can be pretty certain that that arrogance is not to be found. For the absence of a closed heart, if the heart is closed, then that's the only way arrogance can have an expression. So the next time we begin to feel judgmental, higher than, better than, perhaps the willingness to come into some humility and to listen. And it's also worthwhile for each of us to watch the situations in which we refuse to listen. Just notice them. You know, to your spouse, to your significant others, where you know better. That's where arrogance gets a feeding, where arrogance grows and festers. Because arrogance is a kind of insensitivity. It's a dismissiveness of everyone around us. And therefore, we're cut off from clear comprehension. Clear comprehension is the ally of mindfulness. Mindfulness sees what is in front of its eyes. It may see narrowly, but it also has the ability to see broadly. And when it sees broadly, it sees the context out of which the scene is taking place. Arrogance doesn't have that range of vision. It's narrowly defined, and it's only about self and one's own empowerment. And therefore everything, when I say everything, I mean the heart, because it's only within the context of a situation that the heart can come into play. It's only when you see what is occurring, not just what's in front of our eyes, but the context, that we can acknowledge not only the humanity, but the pain within that humanity of the people whom we are listening or speaking to. And it's that range, that spreading out of the view, that allows the fullness of the connection to occur. And it's interesting about arrogance, because feedback is just, an arrogant person is just closed to feedback. Now, there, I want to point towards the insidious quality of this. There was a Zen teacher who had a large sangha and started having affairs with sangha members and was caught in those affairs and was confronted with them. And when confronted, he refused to apologize for them, and half the sangha left and half the sangha stayed with him, because he was very charismatic. And he said to the sangha that remained, "Who's to say what constitutes unethical behavior?" Now, if I ever make that statement to you, get in your car. You're to say what constitutes unethical behavior. It's not for me to set this standard and then move the bar down and up according to my likes or dislikes. But it's the epitome of arrogance that a person could be seated in a position of teaching and then manipulate ethical conduct to fit his or her expression. And it is rampant in many spiritual scenes. And what the bind is that you, the student, have is that you don't know whether it's a teaching or not. And so you can get caught into this whole, and if you stay in this scene long enough, some teacher or other will bring you into this kind of logic, this kind of entrapment, where whatever he or she does is just a lesson that you are to work with. And therefore, anything goes. In the Tibetan tradition, it's called crazy wisdom. I would just call it craziness. Because it relegates you as completely impotent and powerless. Don't ever allow that to occur. in yourself. Because find a path that doesn't have crazy wisdom somehow within it. Because it's craziness, really. And it festers a sense of self-doubt. And it festers a sense of, gosh, is he doing this for my own learning? Giving all the power to the teacher, in which the display of arrogance can undermine virtually any sense of one's own or the student's own stability. Good. There have been teachers in every tradition who have done that. I knew one teacher who would give the precepts quite frequently on retreats, and suddenly he started to downplay the third precept, which is refraining from sexual misconduct. And he said, we're just not going to play that one out so much. Well, lo and behold, this teacher was playing it out himself in and through retreat. Always feel your own power. And don't let the arrogant display of confidence send you back on your heels, questioning yourself. Just leave. It's not worth it. You won't make a mistake. Just leave. Because the doubting mind, you see, when you look at the two forms, you would think that doubting mind is almost the opposite of the arrogant mind. One extremely confident and forthright, the other sort of going back and questioning and not having much inward stability. But if when you look at it, the doubting mind is by far the safer of those two distortions, because at least the doubting mind is willing to hear feedback. Yes, they self-blame for everything, but that's very correctable. The arrogant mind isn't willing to hear anything in terms of feedback, and therefore it's not correctable and hopelessly self-involved. So if you have to go one way or the other, go to self-doubt. Which brings in a different point, you see. Because what's the difference between confidence and arrogance? Now, some of you weren't here last week as we talked a little bit about confidence, so I just want to reinforce it. An arrogant mind, they look, to the outside observer, remarkably similar. To the untrained eye, they look remarkably similar because both are exuding a kind of firmness of place and assurance of words or disposition or whatever. But confidence is based upon not knowledge, but the knowing of Dharma, the knowing of truth. And so it's not that self-doubt doesn't arise, it just doesn't take hold. And so the confidence comes from the fact that nothing can take root and take hold, because the knowing is that nothing is worth giving it further story. And so when the mind wavers, it's seen as that and allowed to release. And so it's really an empty mind, a mind that knows, has self-knowledge, that is a competent mind, spiritually competent mind. Competent with an F. Whereas an arrogant mind is really a mind that is based in self-protection. Because the pain, historical or otherwise, it doesn't matter where it's come from, has led to a real sense of diminishment of self. And to counteract that sense of diminishment, we play forth the arrogant pattern, which is in direct opposition to the feeling we have in ourselves about ourselves. So the two, although may appear very similar are very, very far apart in terms of their root causes, the root effects. You see, confidence, and we use the symbolism of touching the earth, when one is aligned in with their integrity, there's no questioning one's intention or motivation or history. We don't have to glance back to see if the tax man is coming or our wife catches us in the affair, because there isn't one. And therefore, the knock on the door, the accusation, and the complete knowing in oneself of the innocence, even though perhaps no one else believes it. You're carted off to jail, spend 5 years for some crime that you didn't commit, and nothing changes in you because the groundedness is there. Nothing has wavered. Whereas the arrogant mind can be thrown off base very quickly. And how it is thrown off base is through anger. Arrogance is very close to anger. If you hold a lot of arrogance in position or status or skill or knowledge, then if that knowledge is ever tested through student or something, if you're ever thrown off a little bit, then that wavering often kicks forth anger. Because the confidence isn't touching the ground. It's self-protection, not self-understanding. And perhaps most devastating is that the arrogant mind has very little to learn, because it knows. The confident mind has everything to learn, because it bases itself in not knowing, in not finding a position or posture in relationship to anything or any expression of skill or talent. So what is behind, where is the sense of arrogance derived from? What is at the base of that fear? It's interesting. It's the fear, for almost all cases of arrogance, it's the fear of ordinariness. Fear of being ordinary. The arrogant mind holds with such despise and contempt sameness. Because in sameness, there's no, there's no specialness. There's nothing to fix one's light upon. Ordinariness. It's very interesting, you see, because the arrogant mind flees from ordinariness. But they don't flee from the Dharma, because the Dharma feels very special. So I'll go to the Dharma, but when it begins ingesting in, what does it ingest in? It ingests in ordinariness. Then I'm out of here. I've got to find another. And especially when you see it in the teacher. Geez, I'm not studying with that guy. That person. Who wants to study with somebody who's ordinary? Look at him. No sophistication. doesn't even have a PhD. You see, and then, or we just look for some trait in the person, and then we see ordinariness, which we see ourselves, see? We see ourselves. Oh, he's inconsistent. He says one thing and then he does that. Or he makes this big statement about this and I saw him do that. And one time he said this to me. Him or her, I'm not just... And we just, because we have such disgust for ordinariness in ourselves that we're not going to allow ourselves to be taught by somebody who we can perceive as that way. Neither are we going to let the Dharma really affect us back into where it has to point, which is to being ordinary. Back into the fold, so to speak. You know, and we have an idea of what it means. We'll all be like sheep. And you just, no, it's not like that at all. And the difference between uniqueness and specialness. Every one of us is unique. None of us are special. Each one of us has a unique display of character, traits, talents, skills, knowledge base, all beautiful array. Like one turn of the kaleidoscope, beautiful. Next turn, oh, that's beautiful too. And you have thousands of turns of the kaleidoscope. Each one of us is unique. But we make that, or try to take that uniqueness into specialness because we see uniqueness not for what it is, but it's ordinary, because it doesn't win races, it doesn't make straight A's necessarily. In fact, how we evaluate life and what's important to us, it may not have any of those ingredients. Doesn't matter that it's just as unique in its patterning, in its display, but we want to be special, which is not fostered by the Dharma. Uniqueness is. Originality, creativity comes from uniqueness. Specialness covers over those qualities, hides those qualities. As we make a statement from uniqueness into our specialness. Do people see that? And so the arrogant mind doesn't want you to look too closely. It wants you to listen to whatever he or she might be saying. Listen to me, but don't give me much scrutiny. Because when you do, what I'm afraid you will see is my ordinariness, which I'm trying to hide from by displaying my arrogance, my pomp. My knowledge. So you seek me, seek the arrogant mind for answers, but don't ask for intimacy. Don't ask for intimacy. If you look too closely, you'll see my pain, and that'll pull me down. And there's nothing I detest in life more than to fall off my ladder. We see that as a weakness beyond all weaknesses. So arrogance is inevitably on the road to bitterness. It has to be. Because it can't maintain what it needs without constant dismissal and avoidance. And therefore it inevitably has to move towards bitterness. Some people, we get into the Dharma that way, don't we? we hear the instructions of the meditation. Just let life come to you. That's so ordinary. You know, breathing, sight, sounds. What's special about that? So we try to make something special out of that. Let me see if I can create really good samadhi. And I'll just, you know, even though, and then you say, in an interview, it comes up with, you know, all that effort towards being so exact and detailed in everything you do is not the point of the practice. And we listen to that, but that doesn't, but the point of the practice doesn't arouse anything in us but just kind of normalcy. And I don't want to be, I want to have the best samadhi. Or whatever aspect we might have. The best ethics. And even though there's a touch of arrogance within, you see, whenever there's the best, there's got to be that arrogant edge along. Well, you've got good samadhi, but you have to keep working a little more. And I'll show you how to do that, you see. So, you know, to get that kind of arrogant edge, you can feel it. Whereas the Dharma is just, that is where we are most needy. In avoiding our pain, then we have to go through that corridor and we have to champion ourselves in that line only to have the rug pulled out from under us, which is inevitably what the Dharma will do. It'll allow you to build yourself up as the best this or that within the Dharma frame of reference, then it'll just pull the rug right out from under you and you'll fall. You have to. Because running from pain is not dharmic. Building oneself up is a dharma. Trying to find what's special about us and what is a source of pain that is being driven because we refuse to acknowledge that we're not special at all. Unique, but not special. I find it interesting, you see, when we really begin to understand the Dharma and what humility is in essence. What is humility? It's abiding without story. That's the essence of humility. It's looking at those photographs and tearing. Because you see ourself in the multiple displays of our own face, on each face in the photograph. It's the non-division, non-separation. It's the richness of the heart. It's the only place that the heart can be filled, that the heart can come and start beating, is in humility. Not pretentious humility. Not self-negation. Not trying to smother ourselves down because we feel so arrogant. We feel like we have to keep a lead weight on ourselves and pretend humility. It's seeing what the self is. That's humility. You see it and you can't be arrogant because there's nothing there that holds arrogance anymore. It's like a pitcher without a bottom. It doesn't hold the milk. And it doesn't mean that we don't have knowledge and use it, but knowledge is a beautiful tool to have. Builds roads and bridges. Or even express and teach. That's beautiful as well. Teach knowledge. It's a wonderful display. But how we hold the knowledge and the arrogance around our particular knowledge, as if one knowledge set of knowledge base was better than another set. What if we get that one? Where is the woodworker, the knowledge of the woodworker or the artist, less than that of the physician or the lawyer? Where do we get that, that some knowledge is worth being arrogant about? I don't see it in nature. To use the knowledge and the skills we've been provided is the expression of uniqueness. And if we have a sharp intellect, great. We can work with that one as well. But where we rest on it, where there's a story that begins to proliferate around it, where we take a seat and then judge from that seating, we can be sure that if we just turn our heads a little, we'll find pain behind that seat that we have taken. And real humility is willingness to feel that pain rather than just to flee and make more pretension from it. That's where the difference between humility and arrogance really is. If we see the pain that we carry and the pain in the other people's hearts, there's no way that we can remain arrogant, because what we see is like a looking glass into the humane eyes of the whole human consciousness. As we did, as that photographic display takes you right into it. Africa, Asia, South America, North America, Alaska, wherever. And then there is this gentle abiding, this gentle resting, and a kind of tenderness to life, a sort of vulnerability. More than vulnerability, I would say it's innocence, which is the door through which uniqueness can display itself. Twist and turn, or distort or tie, or stand and proclaim, and the door closes, never to be opened again, until we are willing once more to come to the base of our humanity and to see from that base. The whole effort of Dharma is to come to our ordinariness. May we all do so. If we could sit for just a minute or two. So we have some time now for questions or comments, if anyone would like. Yes. Yes. Yes.
How do you celebrate uniqueness and creativity without becoming an arrogant?
So the question is, how do you celebrate uniqueness and spontaneity and creativity without becoming arrogant? You were onto something there, because as soon as we notice it and stand upon it, then we become arrogant about it. It becomes a position that we take in relationship to it, rather than just the display of it passing through us. The uniqueness is there without the posture being taken, without the stand. Isn't that true? It's just that we don't believe in it. We don't have confidence that we can be unique without monitoring that uniqueness and encouraging it and reinforcing it. And as soon as we do, then we set ourselves up to compare our uniqueness with other people's display, rather than just manifesting the uniqueness as it might arise. So spontaneity is the absence of knowledge that you know you're unique, you might say. and the full embodiment and abiding within that uniqueness. So, in other words, it's not constantly self-referencing. Any judgment, by its very nature, has to be self-referencing. You're looking at this person's quality compared to how you perceive your own. So what if we just gave that up? You see how much faith it takes to be able to do that? Because first of all, it leaves you positionless. Secondly, you're not sure that it won't be gone with your lack of noticing. Right? That if I don't notice it, it will go away. Well, that's basically at the heart of the Dharma problem, isn't it? We have to notice everything. And we can't keep our hands off what we notice. So from that noticing comes comparison and judgment and all of the tentacles of power and control and influence. And also comes out like we are outside of life looking at it. That's part of that reflecting upon. The only way we can do that is by thinking about it. So we hold thought to be the highest level display of our arrogance, because that allows a reflective quality to see ourselves in reflection, like a mirror reflecting the quality. And by thinking, I can also compare myself to the other displays that I see around me. And I hold in thought my display in comparison to others. We stop thinking, we have no referencing. See, this is the leap of faith that inevitably Dharma will bring us to. Trust. Risking. Faith. Those are all the same words. Yes. So the question is, where does ego play in the display of arrogance? Any stand that we take in relationship to ourselves is an egoic stand. Any time we proclaim ourselves from role or from position, we're proclaiming the story of ourselves. We're on a podium, be it a beneficial aspect or a poor one. That's not the point. The point is that we're on a podium and allowing people to notice whatever display is being presented. That podium, standing on that podium, is the activity, the egoic activity of a mind that needs a position, that needs a role, that needs a story to know itself. You see? Arrogance is a part of that story. Actually, all the distortions of mind are displays or presentations egoically of the ego. So when we watch arrogance, we're just watching one way that the ego plays itself out through story. Now, when you hear that, you go, oh, God, you know, the ego, I've got to get rid of it. And I've got... That's the wrong way to approach this thing. Because that's arrogance doing something about itself. I know best what's for me. The absence of ego is best for me. That's arrogance. So what is counter to the flow of arrogance? Learning and feedback. So if I'm willing to learn about myself, then I have to stay humble in relationship to myself. And if I'm willing to listen to feedback about what others see and engage in meaningful dialogue around that, well, those are antithesis to the strategies of arrogance. And so I can keep myself humbly facing myself rather than arrogantly facing myself. That makes all the difference. Because ego feeds upon the way, the presentation, the relationship you have to life, not about what it does. You can do anything egoic with ego or with ego with a lack of ego. The same thing can be done either way, right? But if you're keeping yourself in check all the time, you can be pretty darn sure that whatever display comes up is going to have arrogance within it. If you keep yourself learning about yourself, you can be pretty sure that whatever display occurs will have humility in it. There's nothing more humbling than to see yourself. It is the epitome of humility. Because you see why it is that you're doing the things you're doing. And whenever we see the motivation for why we do things, we're back to ground zero. Right? Yes. So she says that she feels the rub between the wanting to be special and apart, and at the same time the longing in the heart to rejoin. Did I say that okay? I would stay very aware of that rub between those two. I wouldn't try to move myself towards either direction of that rub. I can assure you that if you pay enough attention, the longing to rejoin will outweigh the need to be special. Because the longing to rejoin is not built upon pain. It's built upon the heart's tenderness. And that's where the greatest satisfaction and vitality of life rests. The other is built upon pain. And if you pay enough attention, you'll see that. And you won't foster behavior that encourages more pain. You can't do that once you see the link between the two. And you'll fall back and allow yourself to rejoin your heart's need. But again, it takes learning. It takes the posture of receptivity rather than the war of intense struggle. Does that make sense to you? Be very careful of the strategies you employ. The means replicates the ends you seek. If you are battling yourself contemptuously, then the goal that is going to be manifested is cynicism, hatred, and anger. Because the means can't do anything else but to lead you there. And you'll find yourself turning away from the practice because this isn't doing it for me. It's failed me. Many people do that. Many people. Because they don't see the subtle ways that they're holding their advantage in life, whatever that may be, and bringing it into their meditation and playing upon it. This requires such acute sensitivity in oneself that you know it's like the sensitivity of feeling a very small spider on the back of your hand, the footfalls of a very small spider. That's the level of listening and gentleness to keep the whole thing honest that's required of us. And that's possible in lay life. That's what's amazing, is that I'm seeing people in lay life, some of whom never venture into a retreat, or at least long retreats, moving because of sincerity. Sincerity is the great motivator and driver. And if the heart's sincere, that means you're on to it. You know what the heart feels like and you want it. You want the heart. Just what you said. And you're also willing to go in and see the pain of its opposite direction. You're willing to do that? Okay. So in other words, you're seeing humility and arrogance play itself out in your life, moment after moment. If we're willing to do that, then everything comes forth through that sincerity. Samadhi. Samadhi, you're right there. You're noticing because you're interested. We lead with interest, not with rote techniques in lay life. You have to lead with your interest. You can't lead just following your breath all the time like you do on retreat. That's a good way on retreat, but it's meaningless in lay life because you don't have that kind of access. But there's something just as valuable and just as cultivating, and that's your interest, your heart's allure. So foster, spend time looking at both of those equations. See qualitatively which one feels better, which one delights. Where do you delight? Where is your aliveness activated, and where are you most dead? Yes.
You mentioned something earlier about self-blame and the need to correct that.
Yes.
I'm feeling very attracted to self-blame. What's the dynamic of that? How about release that?
She said that she's feeling very attracted to self-blame, and she'd like to know more about the dynamic. And first, I want to honor your invitation to look, because you see this occurring. And you're drawn, okay, now what's going on here? So that you're often drawn into the sincerity and humility of self-examination, right? So self-blame is, I mean, it has the same dynamic as any other blame, really. It's that the finger's got to point somewhere. So instead of being willing to face the pain without pointing fingers, we first point, some people start by pointing outwardly. You did this to me, my boss, my girlfriend, my this or that. And then when we see that that person never really brought those emotions up in us, that was not what accurately occurred. And so we can't say, you make me happy or you make me angry. Both of those are just insane. Then many of us, because of our psychic disposition, say it's my fault. We fall back into our own sense of all problems rest here with me, that I've never been up to the task and I never will. That's a new storyline. So instead of the old storyline, which is you did it to me, now there's a new storyline and I'm doing it to myself. That's not really holding the pain. That's looking for a way to justify why I have this pain. And when I justify it because I'm not up to the task, then I can accept the fact that I have it because I'm no good. Or I can accept the fact that I have it because you did it to me. But that's not equanimity. Equanimity is the willingness not to point fingers and not to distract ourselves by blaming either outwardly or inwardly. And then I can just be present to pain. It's no longer my pain anymore, because even the sense of my has a kind of analysis to it. And then, believe it or not, when that final link, when the finger finally tires and drops, there's no more pain. Said differently, there's no more fear of the pain. We've tried to label, to pin the tail of my pain onto you or onto me, because I was afraid of having it there without that. It's the only thing that I can make sense of. But there's a third way. And that third way raises us to the new dimension in which awareness rules. Now it's no longer little me and the rest of the world, or poor me and the rest of the world. It's the whole world. When we're not pointing fingers, the whole world comes through the lack of directedness, the lack of blame. So I've just ran you through the entire practice. So just being aware of how we still have tendencies to blame externally and blame internally. Just to be aware of that tendency. And to well, what's going on here? What is happening here? That's a question not to analyze it psychologically, but to actually go to the experience of what's going on in this moment. And you'll begin to see where the wavering comes from, where the finger pointing comes from. Yes.
I really like what you said about the proximity of arrogance and anger. I'm in a bind right now in the sense of being an American right now is very antithetical. It's very uncomfortable. And I can see being surrounded by people that don't want to admit their errors and wasting a lot of feel sort of arrogance on my part in seeing that. And there's a humor here that I've lost. What's happened, that I got stuck in the anger and arrogance and lost the humor of the situation.
Yes, good. Beautiful. Beautiful. So he was talking about being an American and how the arrogance of America and then the arrogance of those of us who feel like America is going the wrong way and we know the right way for it to go and all of that. Losing the humor, you see, the humor is the cosmic observation, is the clear comprehension. You see, with the humor comes the heart. With the clear comprehension that I mentioned in the talk, you're not in a positionality anymore. Or it wouldn't be humorous. Humor is a scene. The positionality that you have taken and how, my God, look at that. You see, it becomes humorous. So it's the broad view. Humor only arises in the broad view. When you can see the human condition, not from being abiding in the human condition. And so humor is a very important aspect of humility and self-inquiry. I mean, you've got to laugh at it. It's like, wow, look at this, I'm doing this again. And again, and again. It's like, whoa. Smile. So, if you can foster that sense of clear comprehension, of being able to look beyond where our stake in life is, where we have, you know, rested our moral righteousness, when we can look and relax that a little bit, then surely we will smile. Or we will cry. Both of those are equal. Both of those are the same. Tears follow grief. The response of grief follows as humor does. When you see where you have tied yourself up in a knot, and you see that you don't have to have done that to yourself, and you no longer have to live that way, often there's this enormous sense of grief that comes in. And that's, again, it's clear comprehension. It's the effect. Seeing has an effect. We're allowing life to have an effect upon us. Are we questioned out? Yes.
I see the beginning
question is how to work with children when they display arrogance for even younger children or for other children. You know, I mean, if you you have to be very careful doing more to someone, because doing more to someone is essentially the same ingredient as doing more to oneself. And that just complicates dimensions within oneself and reactions within oneself. And to punish or to, you know, to have a talking with, it just sends the seeds of the pain deeper inside your psyche, where you see that there's a certain behavior, even though you still feel like doing it, cannot come up. So the arrogance can become internalized and depression. I mean, all sorts of things. So I don't know the right answer to this. But I think listening has something to play in this, a part to play in this. And an exploration, a genuine exploration, not a reprimand, you know, where you actually want to know. So what went on there? Can you talk about some exploration of the dimensions in which the child was acting, or with not from a sense of blame or finding fault? And then that can be opened so that that child can begin to open into those dimensions of anger and annoyance and all the things that we carry with us, the seeds of which we carry with us as children that blossom fully when we're adults. I'm not very knowledgeable about how to work with children. But I know there's a natural, depending upon a certain age, there's a natural innocence, a natural curiosity, a natural wonderment that is very precious to the human heart. And if we can foster and encourage that over time, I think we do enormous service to the young. Okay, thank you for this evening.